Talk given Saturday, 22nd March, 1980. All through these years that we have met, we have considered together the deepest things concerning religion and the religious life. We have tried to sense transcendence. It's hardly possible to do anything beyond sensing transcendence. If the sense of transcendence stirs within us, then indeed our meetings have been fruitful and worthwhile. But if it doesn't, well then we have lost something. We have tried to understand ourselves, our problems, and the resolution of those problems, and to obtain even a passing glimpse, but we hope a true glimpse, of the purpose or meaning of life. We have tried to obtain a vision of the art of living, not mere information or ideas concerning it, but at the awakening of a true vision of the art of living religiously, so that life's trend and purpose may fulfill itself through us. So much of what I have said through these years is an askesis, that is, an allowing of all unessentials to drop away and leave us free of conflicts, illusions, false images about ourselves, about other people, about the world in which we live, and about everything that concerns our everyday life. And to be free of enslaving identifications with our race, our nationality, our particular country, our creed, our beliefs, our convictions, and so forth. And to be free of the killing burden for which we ourselves are responsible, of unnecessary sorrow. But the question arises, have we become happy ascetics? Normally the ascetic, I should say not normally, but ordinarily, the ascetic is by no means a truly happy person. And if he's not a truly happy person, he cannot be a truly good person. Goodness and happiness are inextricably woven up with each other. But happiness in the religious context and in the religious sense, which is something utterly different from the hedonistic, life-squandering activities of the vast bulk of human beings over the globe. Have we become free human beings? Or have we given mere intellectual assent to what we desire to keep on grasping for ourselves? Especially since we are concerned with religion as such, with clinging to popular beliefs such as rebirth, and I should have said beliefs in their popular form, such as rebirth, the belief in an entity self, something which is permanently oneself. I, John Smith, will everlastingly be John Smith, and so forth. to clinging to popular beliefs in the popular form regarding reward and punishment, the misconception of karma as such, or heaven and hell for this entity self, and especially clinging to the idea that we can, by striving hard enough, attain, that is to say, one as an entity self, attain a postulated nirvana or a kingdom of heaven. I know this sort of ascesis is really terrifying. People ask, as somebody did at the Buddhist summer school last year, the things you say completely deprive us of any incentive to live the good life. If there is absolutely nothing at all for me, then why should I strive? The answer simply is, all right, don't strive and just see what happens to you. Now, it is important to understand why these things have been said. In our life, in our everyday life, our conflicts, our strivings, and so on, produce energy within the confines of separate selfness. Within that sphere. That sphere of separate selfness consists of the self-center, the relating to oneself of everything, the self-center of the immense sphere in which the self moves to the circumference and back. The self defines its own circumference. It is either one's own self, the totally selfish person, or just one's own family, or one's community, or social circle, or nation, or it may be this world, or it may embrace the whole of the cosmos, if you like. But that is just an illusory, wishful thought projection. No one can embrace the cosmos even in his thought. One says the word cosmos, but it is not a real something in the mind of the person. It's too vast to comprehend. One may apprehend the cosmos because of scientific knowledge, but you can't comprehend it, hold it within your mental grasp. Thus, this energy in action leaves us imprisoned within the sphere of selfness. There is no freedom. Only an illusion of freedom within our star and circle solitude. And this energy, expending itself in asserting separate selfness, peters out. One is exhausted. What is the extent of the full self sphere? It is nothing less, in fact, than the Big Bang and all its consequences. From the time the Big Bang started and the whole expanding universe, as we know it scientifically, came into being, this striving, the energy released through the striving and conflict which the individual organism or person or thing undergoes releases an energy which just peters out. In science we have the idea of the second law of thermodynamics, isn't it? That the whole universe is running down and it will come to a condition of no further energy available at all. In contrast to this, consider the primordial creative energy, transcendence itself. Which is infinite and self-replenishing. All this energy which we generate in our everyday life is not self-replenishing. There is the first outburst of energy through desire and then through thinking how we can fulfill that particular desire or ambition and so on. And that comes to an end, it peters out. It's the same with us human beings. When we are born, there is an immense outburst of life energy, and that gradually goes down and down and down ultimately, and it finishes off. Otherwise we'd live forever if it was self-replenishing. And that might be a pity, considering some of the people who live in the world. But the creative energy of transcendence itself is infinite and self-replenishing and hence inexhaustible. It acts in eternity, not in time, nor even perhaps in the timeless, because what we call the timeless is after all experienced by us as individuals within the confines of time. We may enter a state of consciousness of meditation, the Unio Mystica, the cessation as the Buddhists call it, and so forth, at a certain moment through a particular practice, whatever that may be, and then there comes the moment, it may be today, tomorrow, or even 6 or 7 days hence, when one has to get out of it because of bodily needs. So that timelessness is an experience which is held, confined within the borders of time. So don't say that timelessness is identical with eternity. Eternity is something which is utterly indescribable, unimaginable, unthinkable, unformulatable. The timeless is the opposite of time. But eternity is something which is absolutely the context of transcendence itself. Infinity, similarly, is that context. And therefore, this energy in manifestation has no continuity in our sense of the word. Nothing like continuity. It's very important to understand this because so many of the doctrines in the world which promise a permanent heaven or a permanent hell in a hereafter imply a continuity of the separate self as such. But there is no such continuity at all. Where this transcendent energy is concerned, but it is of the nature of the immortal. It is deathless because it never peters out. being self-replenishing and inexhaustible, it never peters out, like all the energy which we ordinarily generate. Now, this primordial creative energy is the absolute is. I think the German word is Istigkeit, the absolute isness. The one only, that or that one, Tad Ekam in India, as it is called, in the Vedic writings, the supreme I am, Ehye Asher Ehye, I am that I am, of the Kabbalistic and Hebrew teaching, it is the Aham Me of Zarathustra, I who am, Avramasda Yest, you'll find that statement. It is the Atman of the Upanishads. And as such is identical with absolute consciousness. Now it's rather important to see this, that this transcendent, primordial, creative energy is itself absolute consciousness. It is identical with the all-knowing knowledge of Mahayana Buddhism, the Sarvajna Jnana of Mahayana Buddhism. This undifferentiated, ultimate, absolute differentiates, and simultaneously consciousness proliferates. Thus arises the transcendent dual presented as prakruti in the Sankhya philosophy and in India, as bina in the Kabbalah, holding within itself the positive and negative together, the male and female in universal interplay, what I have called the timeless conjugation which is creative action in eternity. In connection with this, in terms of our material scientific knowledge, think of, or better still, meditate upon, don't spend time thinking about it, otherwise you'll merely be talking needlessly, but meditate upon it. Let the brain be as quiet as possible and see what emerges in the mind. Meditate upon this in terms of our material scientific knowledge. The double helix activity of DNA, which, you know how DNA was finally analyzed, discovered, and its structure shown what it is by Crick and Watson in Cambridge. Think of that, it's a double helix. There's something quite interesting in this fact, that actually in our organic life you get this transcendent dual represented in this way. And also consider the yogic teaching of the double stream of the Ida and the Pingala nadis, and the one energy, the unification, as Kundalini rises up in the central nadi, the Sushumna. We have in recent years, not only in the East but in the West, we talked a lot about these things and written about them. But it is somewhat futile to talk and write about these things unless one has oneself an awakened sense of transcendence, which sometimes flashes an awareness, a very profound awareness of the reality. And you'll find that if there are times or moments when this occurs in one's own life, after a little while that awareness disappears. But it leaves you with the certainty that there is such a reality, and it is a reality of a nature which cannot be argued about, which cannot be described. People have written such a lot describing the activity of these nadis and the rising of kundalini through the sushumna. Now it is questionable whether any of these people, especially those who advertise quite freely and enjoy, at least they seem to enjoy the fruits of their advertisement, whether they really know what they are talking about or whether they are deceiving themselves and the public. You see seraphic looking photographs of them in some of the media. But don't be led away by all that. He who really, truly realizes this, the rising of this energy which is called Kundalini, doesn't advertise, doesn't take money for the thing, doesn't sell himself, and so forth. One has to be very careful about these things. The differentiations of creative energy proceeding through increasingly grosser stages culminate in what we experience as matter, solid, liquid, gaseous. This primordial creative energy is the supremely subtle state in which it exists and functions on its own plane, in its own context. But as it differentiates in grosser and grosser manifestations. And the final stage is where it becomes concretized, which we recognize as solid, liquid and gas, matter, material things. Complementing this, because this energy is identical with absolute consciousness, complementing this, the proliferation of consciousness ends, comes to its peak, it's not so much a peak as its grossest point in our own human separative and isolative consciousness. Not just as our awareness of everything, but this self-consciousness which we have is of an isolative character, and it separates all objects, and it isolates us from everybody else and from the world and the universe as a whole. So that is its grossest form. Thus, of course, the innumerable many are expressed by the Absolute One. So, the innumerable many constitute the One becomes the many. There is no real difficulty in understanding this. The many is the one is the many. Our isolativeness marks the farthest distance separating absolute consciousness from its original unitary wholeness. Absolute consciousness is just one unitary whole. And that is the that unitary wholeness is the source of all the proliferations of consciousness. This is something which, as far as I'm aware, the modern world is beginning to wake up to more and more. This dual play of energy and consciousness. We think of consciousness only in our terms, namely that the brain, through the activity of the sense organs, recognizes persons, things, etc. Recognizes the particulars which constitute the many. But it recognizes them in terms of separativeness only. And therefore, raises up this the root of all our conflicts in life, the self, I the recognizer, and the not self, that which is recognized, which we, as we say, recognize. So this isolated self-consciousness represents the imprisonment of absolute consciousness in the form of man. We as ordinary men and women are in darkness, in the unenlightened state. And here we can see a very deep and a very inclusive meaning of unenlightenment. Those of you who have gone deeply into the Buddha's teachings know how he talks of the process of the enlightenment. Then light arose. Then he mentions something else and again says, then light arose. It was not so much a question of a light being lit up or the person Siddhartha Gautama setting anything alight. It is simply that the universal process, the transcendent dual, working through Siddhartha Gautama, whose mind was completely freed through his purificatory living of all the adventitious stains which prevent the mind from functioning as it should function. It is because he had done that, it was the transcendent light which just emerged and manifested through him, just as it manifested through Zarathustra or Krishna or any of the great teachers. See, this somewhat throws overboard the popular conceptions in so many directions. But he's a wise person who lets the popular conceptions, which are misconceptions, pass away. They are the old ragged clothes which you can't wear when you are about to give a recital on the concert platform. Underlying the entire becoming process. Now do realize the deep nature of this becoming process, samsara as we call it. It's this differentiation of primordial energy and the proliferation of consciousness. There are not two things which happen. What happens is a one thing but it is more convenient to talk of it in this dual manner. Because otherwise, what is the relationship between manifestation, between matter and consciousness? You see, you miss out the relationship. Here are two phenomena emerging out of the one primordial creative action in eternity. Now, underlying this entire process is the principle of Ritta. Ritta means the eternal order which is inherent in every single particular which comes into being in the becoming process. The eternal order, it's inherent in every single thing and every single human being. Ritta is the source of our categorical moral imperative. It is because men awakened to this profound reality that they have always presented in theistic terms, the moral governance of the universe and God as the absolute good, the absolutely moral, you see. It's a transcendent morality. Now, and this Ritta, it's part of the constitution of the primordial creative energy, and it is the source of our own categorical moral imperative. It impels our developmental process leading to the disimprisonment of consciousness from the unenlightened to the enlightened state, to liberation out of isolativeness into the unitary wholeness of the totality. This Ritta, the transcendent order which is inherent in everything. Each particular person or thing composing the many is finite, temporal, mortal. The totality is the infinite, eternal, immortal. Since the one totality expresses, that is, pushes out of itself, the many, the infinite, eternal, and immortal wholly subsumes the finite, temporal, and mortal. This means that there is a relationship between the absolute and the relative. In terms of energy, there is a relationship between the infinite, self-replenishing energy, termed that, tat. We have this short thing in the Hindu writings, Om Tat Sat. Tat Sat, that indefinable, transcendent that is Sat, the ultimate absolute truth or being. Being not in the sense that we understand being, a particular manifestation. Everything is subsumed within that great mystery. So there is a relationship between the infinite self-replenishing energy, termed that, and the energy that peters out, the energy generated by the strivings and conflicts of isolative selfness. If this were not the case, there would not be any possibility of release out of darkness into light, out of mortality into immortality, out of sorrow into blissful peace. Now do understand, out of mortality into immortality. The particular person, am finite and mortal. It doesn't mean that I become immortal. The I, the me, is the existent, the particular existent. It is the totality which brings into being the particular existent, and then finally dissolves that particular existent. And this dissolution is complete and total. There is nothing in the existent, nothing which makes up the existent, which continues forever and ever in heaven or hell or nirvana or anything like that. But the being has been, because it is subsumed in the totality, is now part and parcel of non-being. Non-being is a reality. What we may in our languages call non-being is as real as any particular being. Non-being is very much alive, and it is wholly alive. It is the whole thing, the transcendent total reality. So, if you like to use theistic terms and identify the total reality with the word God, then God pushes me or you out of itself into being, and then takes back that which is pushed out into itself. Being and non-being have this sort of mysterious relationship. This is why Sri Krishna in the Gita says, being and non-being am I, O Arjuna. He says, am I? I am. I am both being and non-being. So, with what is the dissolution of the being, simply means that the disappearance of the being means that the non-being, the one total reality, is still itself, totally itself. Now you can't picture this, because the brain has no ability to picture that sort of thing. You can't sort of produce a set of words or a set of concepts to represent this, because all concepts are separate things in themselves, and every single word stands for something separate, something finite, something mortal. There is no word. There are words which, like the absolute, eternal, and so forth, which seem to represent that. But they, if you look at them carefully, you will find that they are not positive terms, they are negative terms. Non-being is a negative term. The absolute is a negative term. It is not a positive term. This sort of thing eludes all brain activity. So you have to leave your brains at home when you make this journey into the uncharted abyss. And it's a terrible journey, believe me. And a terrifying journey. Sometimes one may wonder, is this the meaning of the agony in Gethsemane? Is this the meaning of the flight through the uncharted abyss? Is this the meaning also of Nachiketas being sent by his father to the house of the Lord of Death? And it is the Lord of Death who gives the supreme teaching of life, eternal life, to Nachiketas. And the word Nachiketas, the name Nachiketas, means not knowing. He is the unknowing one. All of us who are the very clever knowing ones are never able to be with death and realize the complete factual nature of which would enable us to say I am being and I am non-being simultaneously. You see, if you can meditate on this, keep the brain quiet. In talking about these things, saying them or writing about them, the brain is not quiet, because one can't communicate. If the language isn't there, one can't communicate. The language is an analyzer, a splitter-upper. And then it mechanically synthesizes concepts and produces a particularized system. That is why particularized systems always have a misleading element, a confusing element in them. And if one really appreciates this, one will appreciate why the Buddha taught, put aside, with right wisdom, put aside every single thought, idea, or concept pattern, all the confections, as they are called, the sankharas, which the mind throws out. Because every such confection is tainted with the drawbacks of the mind. And most of them are what we commonly call the moral drawbacks. And if we appreciate that, we will appreciate why all the great teachers laid the greatest emphasis upon living the good life, the pure life, the moral life. So, out of the release out of mortality into immortality means, in actual fact, that the particular being now is no longer an obstruction to transcendence itself functioning through that particular manifestation, John Smith or whoever he may be. And this is the real trend of life in us, and one of the supreme purposes of our existence, that through each one of us, this transcendent whole, the holy, the heiliger, will manifest itself. You won't find this sufficiently clearly suggested in the purely, strictly theistic religions. As such, that is to say, in their conventional orthodox presentation. But it is implicit in them. And the implicitness is indicated, for instance, when Jesus says, I and the Father are one. The Father God is the complete, is the creator, the whole creator, out of himself. Out of itself, the Father God, out of itself, produces the totality, or all that there is in the totality. Let us create man in our own living likeness, in the Old Testament. And in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, of course, that doesn't belong to any theistic religion, but in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad you have that marvelous statement. In the beginning, which is a bad phrase, eternity has no beginning. In the beginning there was only, all this was only the Atma. All this That is to say, the everything which has emerged out of the timeless conjugation of energy differentiating, interplaying with consciousness proliferating. You have to have the two elements for, in order to help us to even begin to glimpse something of this transcendent reality. There was only the Atma, looking around and seeing nothing other than himself, other than itself, it should be translated. It said, I am. Now, the totality saying I am, that I am, is the deep meaning of the word Atma. Because all conceptualizing processes have been laid to rest. You see? That is the Atma. The word Atma has at there, which means the root, which means to eat up. Well, what is eaten up? All our ordinary mental processes and so on, which are invalid and invalidated by the liberation of consciousness into the state of enlightenment, into an awakening to the actuality. So, and of course, that has its counterpart in the Kabbalistic and Hebrew Old Testament also. You have it, and you have it in the Gita. Very, very, very wonderfully presented, and very simply presented. Once you really sort of begin to get it, and you get that sort of extraordinary feeling, ah, yes, I see. You don't see, you know that, and yet you see simultaneously. You have felt the twinge of transcendence. Or shall I put it in these terms, the lightning of transcendence touches you. Talking of lightning, in the Mahayana texts you find the void, the mind which has realized that void, likened unto lightning, unto fireflies, and so forth, you see. And if since there is this possibility, therefore, because of the relationship of the transcendent energy with the energy that peters out, the infinite energy with the energy that peters out, therefore one becomes free from the bondage of time, the bondage imposed by mortality. And then religion and religious living, which leads to the full human fulfillment, comes into being. Now, if one sort of senses all that underlies this, one will realize that in this terrific ascesis, this dropping away of all unessentials, one goes through the most extraordinary experience or experiences which a human being can go through in order to become the full-fledged human being, the Manushya Putra, the son of man, the son of mind, identical with the Brahma Putra, the son of God. So, in a sense, what I've said today is to really to release hope in the true and transcendent sense, not hope in our petty little selfish narrow sense of I hope it will be like this, I hope, which means I wish I'll get this and I'll get that. See, not in that sense. You consider that hymn, O God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come. Is God our hope? Or is our petty little misconception of God as a super Father Christmas, the giver of presents and good things and pleasurable things, is that God? Or is God the giver of totality unto us? These are the things we don't penetrate into. We don't try even to penetrate into them. You look at the lamentations of Jeremiah. It's a most instructive work, the Lamentations of Jeremiah. He bewails that the Lord God has done this, that and the other to him, and you might think, what a terrible God this is, lying in wait for him like a lion or a bear and so forth, and bringing terrible sorrow and all the rest of it upon him. And then he realizes the significance of it all, and comes to the point where he says that the mercies of the transcendent, of God, do not fail him. And he wishes that God will do precisely what, with Jeremiah's enemies, what he has done with Jeremiah. Now one may think that he is wishing horrible ill to others. Not at all. That wish is a noble wish, a true good wish. Because when a man goes through all that, and remember that God does it all, this transcendent truth, goodness, beauty, reality, purity, it is that energy which does all this to the individual. And thereby the fulfillment of the individual is the fulfillment of the divine itself.